Hi, Drew and Jonathan Scott here. American Family Insurance can help protect your dream home for whatever comes next. You can live in your own oasis or your own clubhouse. Whatever you choose, get the right coverage. Save up to 23% by bundling home and auto. Life's better when you're under American Family's roof. Insure carefully, dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. Products not available in every state. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies. 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
Hey everybody, it's Nicole Byer here with some hot takes from Wayfair. A cozy corduroy sectional from Wayfair? Yeah, that's a hot take. Go on and add it to your cart and take it. A pink glam nightstand from Wayfair? Scalding hot take. Take it before I do. A mid-century modern cabinet from Wayfair that doubles as a wine bar? Do I have to say it? It's a hot take. Get it at Wayfair.com and enjoy that free shipping too.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
This is a true crime in real time update from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
What do you do when a confession slips from the lips of a man unraveling at the seams? Not once, not twice, but repeatedly. But then right in the middle of it all, while the words are right there, he eats a Bible, spreads filth on himself, and mumbles incoherent thoughts. This is the trial of Richard Allen. I'm Tony Bruschi, and today we're diving headfirst into the most unsettling testimonies yet. The courtroom in Delphi sat in stunned silence as Dr. Monica Walla, a prison psychologist, took the stand. Day 11 of the trial promised to bring some clarity, but instead it blurred the lines between confession and breakdown. Walla told the court that Allen, 7 months into his stay at Westville Correctional Facility, confessed in agonizing detail to the murders of Abby Williams and Libby German. But this wasn't your average confession. It was delivered between bouts of sobbing, headbanging, and toilet flushing. According to Walla, Allen asked to provide a narrative of what happened that day, February 13th, 2017. He described buying beer, lying in wait on the Monongahela Bridge Trail, and following the girls. Then he faltered. "I was going to rape them," he allegedly said, "but I got spooked by a van." And so instead he slashed their throats and buried their bodies beneath branches. He said he'd been living his life normally after the crime, slipping back into routine without suspicion. But the words seemed weightless, rehearsed. And just when the courtroom started to settle into the gravity of it, defense attorney Bradley Rossi pounced. Under cross-examination, Walla admitted that her obsession with the Delphi case stretched far beyond the professional. Social media accounts, podcasts, comment threads. Well, that wasn't just counseling Allen. She was following the investigation like a fan binging a true crime series. The defense framed Walla as more voyeur than professional, suggesting that Allen's confessions were spoon-fed by someone more interested in the narrative than the truth. When asked, Walla confirmed that she had even browsed Allen's case files through the Indiana Department of Corrections database. It cost her not only her job, but also a large chunk of credibility. Still, Walla insisted that Allen's confessions were genuine. But the defense had another story to tell, a story written in the margins of Allen's mind, unraveling day by day in the isolation of solitary confinement. For 13 months, Allen had been under suicide watch. Officers testified that his behavior alternated between eerie silence and disturbing outbursts. There were days when he refused to eat, other times when he smeared feces on his body. He drank from the toilet, he cried, he babbled incoherently, and even tore pages from a Bible to eat. And in the midst of all this chaos, he confessed again and again to crimes no one was sure he even remembered clearly. The prosecution leaned into the confessions, arguing that guilt had gnawed away at Allen from the inside, leaving him with no choice but to admit the truth. Prosecutor Nick McClelland insisted that Allen's erratic behavior was just theater. A ploy designed to undermine his own words when the time came, Allen, McClelland claimed, was trying to have it both ways, confess without consequence. But Rossi painted a different picture. A man unhinged by isolation, desperate for connection, who latched onto anyone who would listen, even if that meant weaving together fragments of reality and fantasy into a confession. The officers assigned to Allen during his stay testified that his words came between violent episodes. They described him banging his head on the walls, muttering to his shadow, and flushing toilet paper obsessively. One officer recalled Allen calling the murders the funniest joke, only to follow it with, "I hope I burn in hell for what I did." But then, as quickly as the confessions came, they unraveled. "I didn't do everything I said I did," Allen reportedly told Walla during one session. "But I did kill Abby and Libby." His words felt like smoke, dissipating. The moment anyone tried to grab hold of them, perhaps the most damning moment of the trial came when the court played a jailhouse recording. In it, Allen can be heard confessing to his wife, Kathy. He asks if she still loves him, warning that he may spend the rest of his life in prison. At one point, he mentions the electric chair, but Kathy cuts him off. "Stop saying that," she tells him, exasperated, as if she's heard these confessions too many times to believe them. The jury watched the video in rapt attention as Allen sat stone-faced, snorting in disbelief as his own words were played back to him. It was hard to tell what was more unnerving, his laughter at inappropriate moments or the blankness in his eyes when he denied everything. Now, later in the day, the courtroom was introduced to another key piece of testimony, Brad Weber, a local resident who lived near the Monon High Bridge Trail. Weber testified that on the day of the murders, he drove home in a white van, the same kind of van Allen mentioned, spooking him into abandoning his plan to rape the girls. It was a small but haunting coincidence, one that aligned perfectly with the prosecution's timeline. Libby German's phone pinged for the last time at 2:31 p.m., just moments after the girls were seen being led down the hill. Weber's testimony placed him in the area at almost the exact same time. And Allen's black Ford Focus, spotted near the trails that same day, further tightening the noose around him. Yet even with these coincidences, the question lingered. Were these confessions the ramblings of a guilty conscience, or the desperate cries of a man on the brink of losing his mind? At times, Allen seemed eager to confess, even writing letters to the warden asking to meet with the victims' families to apologize. But the very next day, he'd lash out, refusing to eat, spreading filth, and mumbling incoherently. His behavior vacillated so wildly that even the officers assigned to watch him seemed unsure whether they were dealing with a man haunted by guilt or one slipping into madness. Still, the prosecution pressed on. They played clip after clip of Allen's confessions, arguing that they were too detailed, too precise, to be dismissed as delusions. They highlighted the sticks found on the girls' bodies, a detail Allen had mentioned in his confession. But the defense was quick to counter, suggesting that Allen had learned these details from discovery paperwork, another unfortunate consequence of the broken prison system. In the video recordings of his interviews with police, Allen seemed to oscillate between cooperation and defensiveness. At first, he described walking the trail alone, monitoring stocks on his phone, a hobby he insisted on. But when pressed about his timeline and clothing, his demeanor shifted. "It's been so long," he said, frustrated. "I don't want to be somebody's fall guy." And when confronted with the bullet allegedly matching his gun found at the crime scene, Allen's disbelief was palpable. "This is ridiculous," he muttered, rocking in his chair, as if the whole world had turned upside down. His wife, Kathy, asked the question everyone was thinking. "How did the bullet from your gun get there?" Allen had no answer. What emerged throughout the day's testimony was a portrait of a man trapped, trapped in his mind, trapped in the system, and perhaps trapped in a lie of his own making. The prosecution wanted the jury to see a guilty man haunted by the weight of his crime. The defense wanted them to see a broken man crumbling under the weight of isolation. And somewhere in between those two narratives, the truth remained elusive, slipping just out of reach. Now, let's talk about where we stand in the case of Richard Allen. This isn't just a trial about what happened to Abby and Libby. It's about the cracks in the system that we're seeing right before our eyes. Allen's confessions, if you can call them that, are tangled in a web of mental collapse, isolation, and professional misconduct. And here's the real puzzle. When someone is confessing between bites of Bible pages and head slams against a cell wall, can you really call that a confession? What's haunting about this case isn't just the crime. It's the way Alan's mind seems to be disintegrating in real time. Confession after confession, the man contradicts himself, says he did it, says he didn't do all of it, or changes his story just enough to make the truth a moving target. Some will argue that guilt weighs heavy, and that's why Alan broke down. Others will say solitary confinement stripped away his sanity, leaving behind a shell of a man desperate to connect with anyone, psychologists, officers, even his own shadow. And what about Dr. Monica Walla? She walked a fine line between professional duty and personal obsession, blurring the boundary between therapist and enthusiast. It's hard to ignore the fact that she followed the Delphi case with the intensity of a fan, engaging with podcasts and forums about the very case she was treating Alan for. If nothing else, it leaves us with a disturbing question. Did she draw the truth out of Alan, or did she push it into him? Then there's the timeline. A white van driven near the scene, the black Ford Focus connected to Alan, and the eerie alignment of phone pings with witness testimony. On paper, it fits. But in the courtroom, it feels like a jigsaw puzzle made of pieces that don't quite snap together. There's always just enough room for reasonable doubt to creep in. We're left with this. Is Alan a man who cracked under guilt, or one who's being framed by the perfect storm of isolation and incompetence? For now, we don't know. And that uncertainty, that unbearable ambiguity, might be the most unsettling part of all. Thanks for listening. I'm Tony Bruschi. If you want to stay up to date on this case and others we cover, be sure to subscribe.
In a world where the darkest secrets lie just beneath the surface.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence says otherwise.
Where hidden killers roam unnoticed in the shadows.
I think you would definitely be looking at a blend of toxic, very bad narcissistic personality traits, and they will be vengeful and possibly resort to violence.
Join Tony Bruschi as he uncovers the truth behind the most chilling cases.
They said it was an accident, but the evidence clearly says otherwise.
Each episode, we dig deep into the minds of those who commit the unthinkable.
To your point on narcissism, he thinks in his own mind how witty he is.
Yeah.
But he lost that jury. I was done with him in 2 minutes.
From unsolved mysteries to infamous crimes.
Geez, you've just talked about how you've taught yourself how to do everything under the sun. I bet you did a YouTube video, How to Best Kill Somebody with a Knife.
Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi takes you where few dare to go.
How does someone with such a dark secret go unnoticed for so long?
With multiple new episodes every single day.
We're not just telling stories, we're seeking justice.
Listen now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search for Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.